Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. It's election day, so if you haven't voted yet, please make sure you get to your polling station and vote in this primary. This morning is going to be dedicated to the arts. It wasn't planned this way, but it was a glorious accident that has turned into a wonderful creation. We hope to start with the fiber arts. We're having a little problem connecting, but we'll let you know about that. We'll move on to events happening in Waitsfield. Then we'll take you to Williamstown, Mass. To see some of Rodin's work. And we'll finish by meeting a Vermont-born composer who has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Music twice. But first, I hope to have Cyrus Brooks of Murals of Vermont. We'll give him a few minutes before we do the backup plan, which is opening up the phones. But Cyrus Brooks and his mother have created this wonderful company, Murals of Vermont. And I hope we can highlight them this morning here at 9 o'clock. We'll see what happens. All right. Anyway, these things happen with Vermont cell phones. A lot of times you call and they go right to voicemail. Mine is never on ring or vibrate, so I rarely, if ever, pick up a phone call. Yeah, you can call me. It's not going to – I'd have to be looking at my phone seeing that there's a call coming in. Anyway, we'll see what happens. I will tell you, I had a wonderful four-day weekend. And I have not really gone on any kind of vacation since the pandemic started. I did run home for a week a couple times to help, clear out my mom's home after she had passed back in September and then again this year in June. This was the longest of my getaways, and it was really 2 days, down the western side of Vermont, stopping in Rutland on Tuesday to have, the most incredible, Reuben sandwich at, Hand Carved by Ernie. It's this wonderful, sandwich shop, and Ernie has now sold it to someone who worked with him, and it was a fabulous Reuben. So there's great lineage. The care and curation of the great meats in sandwiches carries on. But then went to a show at Dorset Theater Festival. On Friday afternoon, they had a matinee, and I think it was called Back Where We Belong or Back Together Again, Back Together Again. And it was the music of Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway. They wrote music together through some of the 70s, and so it was performed by a couple, an actual married couple now. Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack were students together at Howard University in Washington, D.C. They were never romantically involved, but became a great songwriting and a recording duo through the 70s. You kind of forget some of the great songs they had, including Friends, which was covered by – who was it covered by? Not Jackson Browne, but James Taylor. So James Taylor and Donny Hathaway, Roberta Flack, both had this song out at the same time, and were both in like the top 100 on the charts with the same song, two different artists, at the exact same time back in the 70s. I don't remember that happening. I remember the songs, both, renditions. Anyway, after that, I, kept heading south and, went to Mass Mocha for a concert. There they have a nice sized black box theater where live performances are held, and I saw the band Churches, which is a Scottish Scottish indie bands are usually my sweet spot. This is more alt synth pop, led by this little sprite of a singer named Lauren Mahoney. And the crowd ranged in age from about 6 to 65, I'd say. There were at least a dozen kids, 10 or under, who are at this show. And then there's me at the higher end of the demographics. But it was a wonderful show. Great to stay, to get to Mass Mocha for that. And then the next day, I got up, went to Shelburne, Mass for the Shelburne Falls. They have the most incredible Bridge of Flowers. I don't know if any of you have ever been, but over 500 varieties of flowers on this bridge that's no longer used. And so it's a pedestrian bridge, and they do a phenomenal job. Great little town, Shelburne Falls. I got in early when it didn't get too hot. And it's, you know, it's free. It's a donation to help them continue to be able to raise the flowers and keep up this beautiful tourist attraction. And then headed over to Treehouse Brewing, which is a it would be quite a good Vermont brewery as well. They do great work, and they have one of, I think, 3 breweries in Mass. One is in Deerfield. So I hit that, loaded up, and then stopped at the Clark Art Institute, which we'll hear about later this morning. And that is in Williamstown, which is a beautiful college town. If you've never visited, it's just gorgeous. But the Clark has an incredible permanent collection that you'd love. But right now, through about mid-September, there is a Rodin exhibit, and you get to see a lot of the sculptures that he designed, and it is phenomenal. And it was, again, it was great to see the range of ages going to see it. I was pleased to see young kids going and enjoying the artwork of Auguste Rodin, and we'll hear about more about that at 10 o'clock this morning. But we can open up the phones, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I will tell you that I capped off my wonderful weekend of relaxation and running around by playing 9 holes of golf yesterday at Mountain View Country Club in Greensboro. And so I have not played. I've gone out a few times over the last few years and hit some balls, but I have not played on a course in many years. And so I was a little nervous. So I did Sunday get up and go out to, the Lang Farm there and, hit some balls. And of course I order a size of a bucket, and the guy says, "Why don't you just get the jumbo?" "Oh, sure. Of course I'll get the jumbo." I probably should not have graded up to the jumbo, because by the end then I had some blisters. I had a glove on my left hand. I got blisters on the right. But it was educational to go back out and hit balls and get comfortable with the different clubs. I will say on the driving range, I have this gap wedge, and I was hitting that beautifully, just lofting it 50 to 75 yards. It was gorgeous. It was like, this is great. So I did relearn some things about, you know, what clubs. I've got an odd collection of old, you know, metal woods and some, whatever they call them, rescue clubs, for kind of like fairway woods, metal ones. And I had to figure out what works, what doesn't, when to use them. But I was still pretty nervous. Bought a pair of golf shoes. I had my last pair I blew out, so some balls, because the ones I had in my bag they've probably been sitting around for 15 years. You know, last thing you want to do is tee up and hit a ball and have it split off the opening drive. But I played with two wonderful gentlemen who allowed me the space to be terrible. And that is the president of Mountain View Country Club, Rick Ely, and then Steve Parker, who we've had on the show. He's the superintendent, the golf course superintendent. And it was a wonderful nine holes. We played from about 10 to noon and really relaxing because no matter what I did, right or wrong, they were encouraging and understood, you know, if I swung and missed a few times, which does happen when I get out there. But I'm going to give props to our man, Fred, the Duke of Newbury, because when I mentioned, I don't know what day it was last week, Wednesday or Thursday, that I was going to play some golf and I was a little nervous, he focused on the irons. And I have always found irons to be a complete mystery. And when I got out on the driving range on Sunday morning, you know, I started with the irons and from, what did I go from, I don't know, I think low to high or high to low, I don't know. But did work my way through the irons and got comfortable or uncomfortable with some. Knew that there's no way I'm going to hit a two iron ever. I'm just going to pull out one of my fairway woods and clock it that way. But I had some decent shots, just enough that, you know, this is the thing about golf. You hit just enough decent shots to bring you back again to say, you know, if I just improve on the things I screwed up on, I can do this. And there was one par three, you know, I landed it right on the green, although then I think I five putted, and we'll talk about my putting in a moment, but I did loft a few of those pitching wedges and gap wedges up onto the green, played with some confidence in hitting them, and it helps that it was a Monday. There weren't a lot of people on the course. There weren't people pushing us from behind, any kind of foursome, you know, that were running us through. And so it was relaxing for me, and I really enjoyed it. Now, I love this about Mountain View. There's no sand on the course. So you have no greenside bunkers. You have none of the, you know, fairway bunkers, you know. Which one's traps? I can't remember. Anyway, so there's no sand. That's helpful. It has more of a links feel, so some wider fairways. The only water is one small pond, and I was able to navigate around that. Usually I drop about five balls in every little piece of water on a golf course, but I was all right in the one hole that had water. And normally I'm an excellent putter. And this is the thing about this golf course. I don't know if any of you have ever played Mountain View. There isn't one flat green on that course. The course, first of all, the fairways are bumpy. They've got a lot of ripples and swales. And so it really is kind of fun to watch your ball bouncing down the fairway because it's going up and over moguls. It could probably be a good little ski run, some of these holes. But the greens really make it a challenging course. And you never have a nice, easy, flat putt. The reeds can be kind of tricky. And luckily, I had the superintendent and the president with me at times to help me kind of translate what I was seeing on these greens. Nonetheless, I made it through, I think, three holes, and then by the fourth hole, I didn't register scores anymore. There were times I just had to pick a ball up and say, okay, we'll move it out here. there was one hole where I just couldn't get my drive. And so I, you know, dropped out where they hit and played from there. But overall, it wasn't the most embarrassing round of golf I've ever had. And I do want to thank, believe it or not, the Duke of Newbury for some good golf advice. Pay attention to those irons. Get them working. All right, we got a few more minutes. If you want to call in, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Boy, you didn't think you'd wake up to me prattling on for a half hour, but alas, we lost a guest this morning. The rest of the show, it will be, it's all arts. And, we're going to, head next to, Waitsfield. We're going to talk to, Karen Nevin about the Waitsfield Village Meeting House. A lot of stuff going on there through the, month of August. That'll be fun to find out about. On after that to Williamstown, Mass, and the Clark Art Institute. I don't know if you've ever been, but right now through mid-September is a wonderful time to go. The Rodin exhibit that's there is just stunning. It was so neat to see people flocking to it when I was there on Saturday. But make sure when you're at the Clark, head over to the permanent collection somewhere along the line. I learned that, you know, no matter what the major exhibit, the traveling exhibit, you know, that's there, the one you're going to see, like a Degas or, you know, Renoir, make sure you always head over to the permanent collection of these museums. And at the Clark, speaking of Degas, there's a room with Degas paintings, and then one of the ballerinas, the sculptures in a room. And it makes your knees buckle when you see it. There are Remington paintings and sculptures, and you know, his Wild West stuff. It's just beautiful. Renoir, Monet, Winslow, Homer. It was just fabulous. And I was really glad that I made sure that I spent a little time over in the permanent collection. I guess I'm really owning this half hour, so I'm going to tell you a funny little story that occurred when I went there. The Clark has four galleries, and three are together, and then one is kind of up the hill. And I just kept following signs and wound up the hill at this separate kind of satellite gallery, which is for contemporary art. And so I had purchased a ticket online and, you know, had a sheet of paper with it printed out. And there's a woman, you know, selling tickets. And I kind of say, I have a ticket. Do they take it inside? And she just waves me right through. She didn't even, like, listen to what I said. And when I get inside, a security guard walks over to me and he says, I thought you might have been one of us. The security guards are wearing khakis and kind of a lime green polo shirt, and that's exactly what I showed up at the Clark in. And so I'm pretty sure the woman at the window thought I was part of the security team and just thought, oh, yeah, there's a guy from security going in. Well, the security guard stopped me and said, where's your sticker? Huh? He was very kind and gave me great history of the Clark and what was going on in that building and the contemporary art display that was there. But I did have to march back out and show my my ticket and get my sticker. And then he guided me down to the Rodin and the permanent collection, and I had a wonderful time. We'll hear more about that and less about me later. That's at 10 o'clock. All right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to reschedule with Cyrus Brooks from Muriels of Vermont. I don't know if you've ever seen their creations, but they're pretty fabulous. We will learn about that. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll return to find out what's happening in Waitsfield. And the Sox play host to their former cross-city rivals and the defending World Series champion Atlanta Braves tonight. We're on the air at 6:10. Game action gets started at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Back in January, I had a wonderful morning broadcasting live from the VG in Waitsfield. And while I've made my way back to the Valley several times since then, I haven't reconnected with Waitsfield on the show very often since January. So let's make up for that, shall we? We're going to spend the next half hour finding out what's on tap at the Waitsfield Village Meeting House. Joining me to talk about it is Karen Nevin. Karen, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for letting me join you today.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have any questions about the upcoming events at the Waitsfield Village Meeting House, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255 or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Karen, what is the Waitsfield Village Meeting House?
Well, the Waitsfield Village Meeting House is part of the Waitsfield United Church of Christ. The beautiful, iconic church in the center of town across from Village Grocery has spent its time trying to open up its doors and be available for the community in a million different ways. And we host events there, concerts, music. People use our space for all sorts of purposes. And it's a village meeting house, a place where the village can come and be and meet. And so it is a new direction for the church, or actually maybe not a new direction, but a newly stated direction and goal and mission that is to just be open. This is a beautiful facility, and it's wasted if it's only open to the public one day a week for 2 hours on a Sunday. So it's open all the time.
Can you give us a little history about the building, maybe a little quick tour?
Oh, my goodness. You're putting me on the spot.
That's what I do.
So the church, I believe, is 100-plus years old, many, many, many years old. I do remember that it was once upon a time up on Common Road in Waitsfield, and it was moved down to the center of town. That was way back when people thought that moving a church was easy to do. It's undergone a couple of renovations over the years. One of the significant ones was about 25 years ago. We redid the steeple. It's an iconic building, an iconic steeple that is used for photographing the valley many, many times, and it's beautiful. And then 4 years ago, I think, we undertook what really was a massive renovation, understanding that this 100-plus-year-old church, we had a choice, not do anything and let it disintegrate, or to really invest and make that a building that could be used by the community for years to come. And we undertook that that renovation. It required funding of, I believe, at least $300,000, if not $400,000, and certainly more than that. I am remembering, just as a person in the church, not as being involved, other than I know I gave money to the project.
You're doing quite well for someone who was afraid to answer that question. I love the whole idea of it having been moved.
Well, I know. Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
But that was a long time ago.
Sure.
But the renovation is what made it the Village Meeting House. We realized things like mold and musty cellars and falling apart walls and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so the entire downstairs was redone. We have a commercial kitchen in there. We have full-size ADA accessibility now, so anyone can get into the building at both levels, with bathrooms that are completely accessible, heating and air quality. All those kind of things were done. And so now it's a beautiful facility. And like I said, it's used by many, many different people and organizations. When the daycare center Neck of the Woods during the COVID periods discovered that their water system had failed on them, we moved the entire daycare center into the basement.
Wow.
Of the space and let them be there for 6 months while they raise the money to redo their water and septic system. So that's the work that this community does, and that's what the Village Meeting House is all about.
And you've got a very interesting August. So this month you're presenting the art of painter Janet McKenzie. What can you tell us about the artist?
So this is what we're so excited about.
Yeah.
Janet McKenzie is an artist from the Northeast Kingdom, and she paints her paintings are about social justice, racial justice, inclusivity, diversity. And we actually had her exhibit at our church back in 2014. And in January 2020, I invited her to come back, and you all know what happened. We had to postpone that exhibit for 2 years. And finally, it's opening up to, this Saturday. This is the first exhibit of Janet McKenzie's paintings since the pandemic, and her last show was in New York City and closed in January 2020. So she is not a minor artist. What she is incredibly famous for a single painting. It's called Jesus of the People, and this painting was done in 2000 as part of a international competition of, you know, what would what does Jesus look like?
Mm-hmm.
And this painting was painted with, it was a black female model. And it caused an uproar. It's a spectacular painting, but it caused an uproar. She received and still receives death threats for this painting. This painting, which is internationally known, will be hanging in our sanctuary in the church. In the middle of her art show. And so just coming to see this painting and seeing what of the idea of the racial justice and just, you know, we're all the same people is so important. But her work, there's a new painting that is her reflection on the massacre at the Pulse nightclub years ago. There's another painting about what she calls it, Mother Mary and the Stolen Chibok Girls. So the 200 plus girls that were stolen in, I don't remember what country in Africa, and they haven't even found them all. This was her reflection on what these girls are going through and how we can protect them. So she really works a lot with female imagery, spirituality, but it's not like, I'm going to say, if people are worried this is a religious show, it's not. It has spiritual overtones, but truly her belief in everyone, we're all the same. No matter what our skin looks like, no matter what our faces look like, we are all the same. And at this point, her work is used in protests around the country for women's rights and for racial justice rights and social rights. It's incredibly powerful stuff.
I will tell you, Karen, that my alma mater, the University of Dayton, which is a Catholic university, was always pretty liberal in the Catholic tradition. And they commissioned Janet McKenzie to do a painting for the school for their collection. They also have 5 of her works in their collection. So
you're familiar.
I am now. When I found that, I felt pretty proud. Why did you think that this was someone whose work you wanted to display again at the Meeting House?
Well, I will say that back in 2020, the world was in a bit of an uproar. The George Floyd situation hadn't occurred yet, but it was certainly, we were heading in that direction. And our, the Village Meeting House has continually thought about, what our role is in the community when it comes to, you know, loving one another and knowing that there are divisions and amongst each other and people. And so we knew that Janet McKenzie, though she may challenge some people, is truly about just love and hope. Her title of her show is Courage, Justice, and Hope. And that's what it is. It takes courage to stand up and look and think and even think personally about these topics, as well as there's hope in doing so and being together as we experience her work. And so it was timely in 2020, and it continues to be timely in 2022. We as a congregation have been working on these issues, equity, diversity, inclusion. I personally have been working on these issues at my work in Waterbury, mm-hmm. and as just a human being. And the topic should not. I constantly think you should walk the walk, not just talk the talk. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is part of walking the walk.
Karen, people will actually have the opportunity to hear Janet McKenzie speak about her paintings. When is that happening?
Yes. So the opening of the art show is this Saturday, starting at noon. And then Janet will be presenting an artist talk at 3 p.m. And Janet is funny. She says, you know, Karen, I'm not sure I really like talking in front of people. I said, that doesn't matter. What we just like to know is we want to know about your inspiration. We know a little bit about your process. Who are these models? What I love about her paintings is every single person that you see is a person of a friend of hers, is someone she knows. Mm-hmm. And so she'll say, well, that little boy really didn't want to sit still for a few minutes for this painting, or that's my son's partner. And so she knows everybody, and she'll tell stories about them, but also an opportunity for us to ask questions and to learn a little bit more about her.
Yeah, I have found that when I've invited painters to be on this program, they're a bit reticent to begin with, and they've been wonderful in letting people know about their craft, and it's really pretty interesting. So when are people able to stop into the Waitsfield Village Meeting House to see the exhibit? Is it open particular hours during the week?
Yes. So what we've done is it opens on Saturday, and then from Saturday to September 4th, it's open on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays from 12 noon to 4 p.m. So if you can't make it during that time and you would really like to see it, just give us a phone call and we can set up a private showing. But for guaranteed entrance, 12 to 4 on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. And anytime you come, there will be greeters there who can answer questions. Janet is also selling prints and cards, so you can take a bit of her work home with you. And we have just wonderful information. This is a rich exhibit that each painting has a little bit of her own personal thought about the painting, and or a quote or some kind of nugget attached to the painting. So it isn't just this, just seeing these artworks of art. We highly recommend people spending some time. I find that when I go in, there's always one painting that just sort of stops me dead in my tracks. And I just spend a lot of time just being with the painting, seeing it, thinking about it. What does it bring up in my own personal self? There's a particular painting this time that has done that for me. So I look forward to visiting every time I go in.
So noon to 4, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and people don't have to make reservations then, right? They can just stop in.
Just come on in. Just
any
come
charge?
On in. We want to see you. No, it's free. Of course, we will always accept donations. We are putting on a show like this does cost money. Actually, one of the reasons it can be completely free is that we received a Spark community grant from the Vermont Community Foundation, mm-hmm. Which is thrilling to help support this and the other summer events that are going on.
That's fantastic. Well, let's talk about another one of those events. You have one scheduled on August 20th. Who is Toussaint Saint-Négretu?
Well, so... First, before we start talking about Toussaint, I do want to say one thing.
Sure.
When Janet agreed to do this show, she challenged us. She said, I will not just hang my artwork. You must do something more. You must bring people to the Village Meeting House, to the artwork in other ways, have them experience. It has to be more than just paintings hanging on the wall. So we have spent a long time working hard and planning, and we are super excited that Toussaint Saint-Négretu is going to be performing for us on Saturday, August 20th, within the art exhibit. And Toussaint is a poet and a musician. He also lives in the Northeast Kingdom, and we had a lovely conversation with him. He's not going to write any special poetry for being in the paintings, but being within the paintings. But he has similar thoughts and beliefs and imagery that he works with himself. So he'll be reading his poetry, but he's also a bass clarinetist, and he will bring his music, some percussion, and he says it's really an improvisational reflection of the music and the paintings and the experience. And I don't know if I can explain it more than that, except that I cannot wait.
All right. So on this Saturday, it is Janet McKenzie giving her talk at 3 o'clock. The following Saturday, the 20th, you have Toussaint Saint-Negritude. And then I think it's the following Saturday, the 27th, you've got the Global Community Festival. So what happens then?
Well, there is the opportunity to just celebrate what we've been experiencing all summer. And we we're bringing in three phenomenal musicians. We're so excited. The Art of Don Cherie. Don Cherie is a soulful blues singer. Micah Haley, I think he's from Madagascar, and he will be performing. And then the Ezra Oakland Jazz Trio. And so we've got really wonderful music beginning at 12 noon to 4. We will also have a variety of food options. Again, we're aiming for global types of foods and that people can just have fun eating and listening to the music. And then we have a community-wide art project, and we will be painting prayer flags. And the hope is that people will see the art show, which will be going on at the same time, listen to great music, eat great food, and then reflect and on their experiences and paint prayer flags. And it is a community-wide art project, and once those flags are painted, we've partnered with the Valley Libraries, and we'll be hanging the community these prayer flags all around the valley, just sort of celebrating the month of experiences surrounding the Janet McKenzie artwork.
What do you hope people who attend these various events throughout the month will take away from attending?
Well, I think a lot of it is exactly what Janet says is hope. Hope for our community, our small community, the Mad River Valley. Hope for the state of Vermont and for our country, in terms of understanding that we are all alike and that we have so many similar ways of seeing the world and being together, and that we should celebrate that. And instead of and if you're a little afraid that you'll be uncomfortable, don't stretch yourself. Stretch yourself. Come, be, and in every case, everyone's going to be welcome. Everyone is going to be caring, and we want everyone to just come and experience it. And so, really, it's hope and encouragement and a desire for justice for everyone in our world. And boy, I'm getting highfalutin, but I think that's what I'm going for.
And Karen, where do people find information on all the events going there on there through the month of August?
You can go to the website waitsfieldchurch.org. As well, all of these events are on local calendars, including the State Vermont Vacation in 7 days. So you should be able to find it in the Mad River Valley Chamber of Commerce calendar. So it's a lot of places. Will be on Facebook as well. Waitsfieldchurch.org, or you can call 802-496-3065.
All right. Karen Nevin, thank you so much for being on with us this morning. We are going to leave with the music from The Art of Don Cherie, For Keeps is what we're going to hear. Thank you so much.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much, Rick.
All right. Take care. We're going to break for CBS News, then we'll get an up close to the thinker and the kiss. And coming up today at 1, 3 big hours of The Getaway with His Excellency Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. For years, I've been telling people that if you're anywhere near Chimney Point, to visit the lighthouse there to see the plaque by Auguste Rodin. Now I'm going to tell you to get in your car, van, or Winnebago and drive to Williamstown, Mass. To visit the Clark Art Institute and see many works by Rodin. Please. Okay, don't take my word for it. I've brought in Alexis Gooden, the associate curator of the Clark Art Institute, to also convince you. Alexis, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be with you this morning.
Lovely to have you. Listeners, to ask Alexis about the Rodin exhibit and about the Clark, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. And if you've already been, you can call and share what you experienced. Alexis, who was Auguste Rodin?
Well, he was a sculptor and a draftsman. He both modeled in clay and drew on paper, living from 1840 to 1917 in Paris mostly, although he spent some time in Belgium and Italy and traveled Europe. He was someone who took an untraditional path towards becoming one of the best-known sculptors in late 19th century, early 20th century France. He was rejected by the traditional school that would train sculptors. He instead studied at the Petite Ecole and worked for other sculptors modeling in their studios. I think he had some time as a jeweler. He worked as a porcelain decorator. He did a lot of different projects and work before he was successful enough to afford his own studio and hire his own assistants. And from that point, he became very interested in representing all manner of subjects. But what he really was interested in was grasping and identifying and sort of communicating emotion, drama, exciting, devastating emotion, whether it was a subject from classical mythology, from Dante's Divine Comedy, even from past history in France. So he was someone who tuned into drama, emotion, and tried to create sculpture that would affect people.
How many different works of his are on display in the exhibition at the Clark?
So we have about 50 sculptures on view here and about 25 drawings. So it's quite a large show. I think what's pretty surprising is that people might know his iconic Thinker or The Kiss with two amorous individuals entwined in an embrace. But for me, working on this exhibition, I was really surprised to see that he was an ardent draftsman, that he produced thousands and thousands of drawings and often experimented with those drawings in ways that he didn't work in sculpture. And his drawings are largely separate from his sculptures. He didn't make drawings to sort of prepare for a sculpture. He made them to refine ideas in his mind just because he loved looking at the world, loved looking at people, worked with live models, and loved capturing movement and emotion. And so he was a draftsman as well as a sculptor, and we've tried to represent the best that American collectors were interested in when they started acquiring works by Rodin for their own private collections as well as for public museums in the United States.
Now, these are his sculptures, yet technically, was he a sculptor?
Well, yes. I mean, that's a little bit of a confusing thing, but this is how sculpture works. He was absolutely the person who created the idea and would model in clay and create smaller versions of things that were later enlarged or maybe reduced in size even. So he became very adept using clay, sometimes wax, sometimes plaster. And from that original model, other models would be made. So he would maybe himself work in plaster and create a mold from that clay model, because clay is very fragile. It dries out, it cracks, it breaks, it's not long lasting. And so he had the ability to then turn that into a plaster, which was a little bit more resilient. So sometimes he would work with studio assistants to create plasters of his clay models. And then he would turn those over to trusted founders who would create an even more long-lasting version of the sculpture in bronze. So he worked with founders in Paris. He also hired assistants or praticiens, very accomplished artists, to carve his models in stone, whether it was granite or marble, and he would supervise these transitions of his original idea into other media. So he would visit the foundry, he would, you know, look at the final work and work with a person who made the patina on the sculpture, creating the surface color finish. He was very much involved with everything, but he didn't do everything. Some sculptors carve in marble. Very few of them, I think, do their own bronze casting. But this is something that's been accepted and done for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm. Now, he is revered today, and judging by the crowds that have been coming to the Clark, he definitely is. But it wasn't always so. As a matter of fact, as we walk into the lobby and behold our first Rodin of the exhibition, it's one that failed to capture the admiration of the public and I think the critics. It's a French author and playwright, Honoré de Balzac. So how did Rodin get it so wrong, or did he?
Well, so he received a commission to create a sculpture of a very revered author who had founded the Society of Letters, and that was the commission. It came from a group that was devoted to Balzac. Balzac had been dead for decades at this point, and Rodin was very systematic. He liked to work from the live model, but he also realized that this was an important commission. And so he started reading abstracts about Balzac, reading summaries of his novels. The man wrote over 90 novels, short stories, all of them interconnected in some way. And then he went to Balzac's birthplace in Touraine and looked at the people who lived in that area and actually found someone that he thought resembled Balzac visually and asked this man, whose name is Etage, to model for him. He was a cart driver. And so Balzac worked with this person to kind of create a very close likeness that looked like Balzac based on prints and photographs that existed of Balzac. But when Rodin was envisioning the monument to him, he thought Balzac was so much more than just the physical likeness of the person who had been long dead. He was a giant of literary achievement. And so he created this really monumental, over life-size, full-scale sculpture of him with very exaggerated features. His eyes are deep gouges. His hair is sort of an unruly mane. His gaze is very profound. And so he kind of reduced the specificity and created this more shocking, more exciting version of Balzac that he thought was a tribute to the genius of this author. And of course, when the society that had commissioned this commemoration saw it, they thought, oh my gosh, this doesn't look anything like Balzac. We're not going to pay for it. And so what Rodin had was a plaster version that he was very happy to show to the world in exhibition, but it was never converted into the long-lasting bronze during his lifetime. And some people did appreciate what Balzac, or what Rodin had done with his Balzac, including the photographer Edward Steichen, who actually made several trips from the United States to France to meet Rodin and to also photograph his wonderful sculpture in plaster. And it wasn't until 1939 that funding was produced and bronze was poured to create the first of, I think, 12 bronzes of this very large monument. And we're very fortunate to have a 1954 cast from the Museum of Modern Art in our collection or in our exhibition right now.
It's a stunning way to start things off. And if you head over to the permanent collection at the Clark, there is another bust that another sculptor had made. And I think that's probably what people more expected the likeness to be of Balzac, from Rodin. We see what appears to be the full-size statue of the thinker, but it's not the original that's in Paris. So what are we seeing here?
Okay, so we have two thinkers on view in the exhibition. Originally, the Thinker was created as part of a scheme, a decorative scheme for a pair of doors that Rodin was commissioned to create for a proposed museum of decorative arts in Paris. That museum was never built, but he did start working on the commission in 1880, and we know that work as the Gates of Hell. And the Gates of Hell is a very monumental sculpture that has hundreds, I think about 200 figures that are incorporated into the doors, into the lintels, into the posts. And the subject of this comes from Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy, and specifically the Inferno. It features tortured souls who are in the circles of hell, writhing, suffering their torments. What Rodin did was he would use this material as a basis for other sculptures, whether he would, you know, take a couple figures that he had modeled for the doors, extract them, make them bigger, exhibit them on their own, and give them their own sort of separate identity. And that's the case of the Thinker. The Thinker was originally modeled to look down on all those writhing, tortured souls and to consider this creation. Now, the Thinker perhaps was a personification of Dante. It might have been a personification of other poets. But Rodin decided it was a successful figure, and he extracted that motif and created small versions. We have a small version from the Yale University Art Gallery in the exhibition. But then in 1903, he enlarged it, and it became this very monumental, very bold sitting figure that embodies both profound thought and resilience and strength. It's a very muscled sculpture.
Yeah.
And so many versions of these were cast. I think there are about 40 smaller thinkers and probably 22 enlarged thinkers, which, by the way, the one in our exhibition is from Baltimore, and it weighs about 1,800 pounds. That was not easy to put into place, but we did it.
You did a nice job.
thank you. Thank you. But yes, there are about 10 different large-scale thinkers in the United States, and we all consider these original works because they are cast from the mold, from the model that Rodin made.
And muscled is a great way to describe it. I walked around. The back is so rippling with muscles. It's a beautiful representation that you don't normally get to see, you know, in photographs. You always see the front of the thinker. Alexis, you use words like passionate and emotional, and I think of The Kiss, which is another powerful creation that's on view at the Clark. How does he create such emotion and desire in a statue like this?
Well, I think it comes from working from live models. He was always interested in observing people in his studio, on the street, and so he captured motion and gesture in a very natural way. I think he was a passionate person. I think he had a lot of character and charisma, and so I think he could imbue his sculpture with some of the passion that he felt in his own life. And I also think that he really worked incessantly to be able to inflect each part of his sculpture with emotion. So we have, as well as full sculptures on view, we have fragments that are just of hands
yeah.
or a foot or just a head. And even in those small parts of bodies, you can have a story be told. There's emotion, there's movement, there's gesture that is just kind of miraculous. And when you have a full sculpture of all a body and have all of these parts sort of working together, he absolutely was a craftsperson, a genius at imbuing his models, his work with emotion and energy. And so he was very practiced. I don't think he slept. I think he worked all the time. He was just absolutely avid in what he did. And in fact, when he died, he left his works to the state and hoped that future bronzes would be made from his plaster and clay models. And that did happen. The Musée Rodin opened 2 years after he died in Paris and in Meudon in 1919. These opened. And all of these pictures from that time show just studio floors, shelves, tables littered with plasters. He just kept everything. He was just so productive. In fact, at one time, I think he had 50-something assistants. So they were helping him produce. And so he was just absolutely, you know, very generative. He had so much to say to the world.
There is a great photograph of him in his studio surrounded by a lot of body parts, these sculpted body parts, which is just stunning to see. Now, I mentioned the Rodin plaque that lives on the shores of Lake Champlain, just on the New York side, and it's of Camille Claudel. Now, one of my favorite pieces at the Clark is of Rodin by Claudel. So what was the connection between those two?
So Camille Claudel began working as a sculptor in her small town and worked with another sculptor of some renown as a teacher. They eventually decided that Camille would be well served to move to Paris and to study in a formal setting. And so her family took her to Paris. She enrolled in art school. And when this first teacher was no longer able to supervise her progress, he asked Auguste Rodin to step in and to supervise this promising pupil. Women were not always sculptors. It was a very difficult field to make headway in, and she was someone who was recognized as having a gift, the way that she could model figures. She carved her own sculpture in marble, and so she fought very hard to earn a place, to both exhibit work, to receive critical acclaim, to have people commission sculpture from her. So part of her journey involved being supervised by Rodin. She eventually was hired by him as a studio assistant, so she helped him with his production. But that was a mutually beneficial arrangement because she would learn from him and the other people in his studio while she was getting paid to help with his production. But their relationship did evolve. I think he was enamored of her and her creative spark and her sort of powerful will, and they formed a romantic relationship, which was a rocky one. At the time, Rodin was still involved with his longtime companion, Rose Barret, and I think there were ups and downs with their relationship, and eventually Camille Claudel thought, because she was getting overlooked in the artistic world, people, I think, were starting to think that she was just Rodin's student, that she wasn't an independent artist, that she wasn't creative on her own. She broke ties with Rodin and really moved out, got her own studio, tried to be self-sufficient. And there was communication between the two of them for some time, but eventually they had a very bad falling out. That said, Rodin still helped support her, would bring critics and patrons to her, helped finance some of the casting of bronzes, including the portrait of himself, which is in the exhibition. Claudel modeled that, but couldn't afford to pay for the bronzes, and Rodin did, and it became his official portrait for a decade, which is saying a lot, that, you know, Camille Claudel understood who he was and created this very important likeness that he felt reflected who he was.
We only have a few minutes left. I've been picking all my favorites. Is there one that you'd like to highlight that's at the exhibition at the Clark?
Well, I love the Cupid and Psyche, which is marble. It's in the first gallery. This is a fun work because it was sort of the start of the relationship between Rodin and America that we really highlight in the exhibition. This is now owned by Iris Cantor. It's in her private collection, and it's very special that she was able to lend it to the Clark. It depicts a couple entwined lovers, Cupid and Psyche, and it's a very sensual, very surprising work. When it was shown at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893, it was deemed erotic, risque, and completely unacceptable for public viewing. And so they took that along with two other marbles that were quite sensuous, and they put them behind closed doors. And basically, the press reported on this, so people knew that Rodin's really evocative, provocative sculptures were in this building, the Fine Arts Palace. But you had to ask for permission to see them. You had to go and sort of put yourself forward. You couldn't just walk by them. And so this work was very scandalous. At the time, nobody decided to acquire it. It was for sale. It went back to Europe, and much later it became the property of this private collector. And what's really wonderful is that today, I think our sensibilities have changed, and we felt very comfortable and very proud to put a beautiful photograph of the sculpture on the cover of our catalog for the exhibition.
Ah, well done. Just a minute to go, but what did eventually lead to Rodin being recognized as an important sculptor after, you know, he went through decades of being shunned?
So, yes, his reputation up and down in this country, and it was in the 1950s, Alfred Barr, who was the director of the Museum of Modern Art, really made a case for acquiring the Balzac sculpture in bronze and said, you know, he's one of the most important sculptors of our generation, of our time, of our century. We need to reevaluate who he is as an artist. And with that, other curators, scholars, collectors started to think, let's reassess Rodin. For a while, it was just his finished marble sculptures that were in museums, not the fragments, not the bronzes that were being shown. So it really encouraged, when the MoMA acquired this work in 1955, it encouraged others to go into their vaults to see what they had in their storage and to sort of revive the reputation of Rodin. And it, today, it's, I think, a very healthy reputation. I think collectors and museums are still eagerly acquiring his work.
No doubt. Alexis Gooden is the associate curator of the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Mass. And you can learn more by visiting clarkart.edu. Alexis, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll be back to meet Vermont-born composer David Rakowski. And just ahead at 11 this morning, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. And we're listening to Ten of a Kind by composer David Rakowski. David was born in St. Albans and is currently a professor of composition at Brandeis University. He's also created dozens of typefaces. We've got to get to all of that eventually. David Rakowski joins us now. David, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Dave. Hi there.
How are you?
A little bit of that got blocked out here, but that's fine. What would you like to know?
Oh, well, I'll start asking you questions in a moment. Listeners, if you'd like to ask David a question, share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Now, David, I want to take you back to junior high school in Vermont, that David Rakowski. Did you have any clue that you were on the path to becoming a composer?
No, not at all. In fact, I thought if I was going to do music at all, it would be as a trombone player. That was my instrument, and I did well at the time, and I got into community bands in the summers. So I got to sight read a lot of things for concerts and get to know a lot of other musicians, who some of whom were a lot older than me. So it was a very nice community. And essentially, it was the community bands that drew me into wanting to pursue music as a career.
Wow. What was the turning point where musical composition became an interest and a passion of yours, David?
The turning point was my sophomore year in high school. I was in the Vermont All-State Band, and we were in Burlington. And since St. Albans is close enough to Burlington to drive within 45 minutes, we didn't stay overnight in Burlington. We had a bus to take us back and forth. But after the first day of rehearsals, the bus broke down. And we had to find something to do while the bus was being serviced. So there was a concert of the entrance and winner of the Vermont All-State Composition Competition. That is the students that entered pieces into their competition every year. And we heard what students had been writing. And I remember the CBU band came and gave a performance of the winning piece, who won $150, I think, called Soliloquy to a Snowstorm. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, wow, you know, someone my age can write a big piece like that. I think I'm going to try to do the same thing and enter in the competition next year, my junior year. So during my February vacation, this would be second week of February in 1975 was when I started writing, and it was very ambitious. I wrote a 7-minute piece for the BFA band. They performed it on June 1st, and I conducted, and it was quite an interesting experience.
Oh, my gosh. I love the way fate intervened. The bus breaks down, and David Rakowski becomes a composer. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, I was the beneficiary of very good teachers in St. Albans, even down to the junior high level, but the one-size-fits-all teacher at BFA was Vern Colburn. And for 4 years, he taught me a lot. And just by example and by lending me recordings and books and also yielding the band so I could conduct it and conduct my own piece. Yeah, and that was great.
That's stunning.
And, you know, I also learned how much work composing is even beyond when you finish the piece, because I wrote a piece for, I guess, had about 20 or 25 different parts. And then the next thing I had to do was copy each individual part. And that was extremely time consuming. And luckily, we had an exchange concert in Scarborough, Ontario, and on the bus is when I did most of the parts.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. And so trombone, I took it for a couple of years back in the day, and it's a little different because it's all about lip, your lips and the slide and where you position that. But were you the type of person who could pick up just about any instrument and begin playing it? Or how did you get, like, the understanding of all those different instruments at that age to compose?
Oh, sure. A part of it is, you know, the community bands I talked about were not that large, so I was able to see everyone playing when the trombone was not playing, which, by the way, is a lot of the time usually. And so I got to see kind of what clarinets looked like when they were being played, what flutes looked like, and so forth. I should say that I was able to pick up just about any brass instrument. So I can play tuba and euphonium and very badly trumpet. And I sort of taught myself all those things. Once I knew how the valves worked and what they meant, then I could kind of just transpose. I might say that twice when I was a graduate student, the tuba player in the band was graduating, so they needed tuba player for the band doing the marches and the music for the graduation ceremony. So I played tuba in that band twice, and I also played euphonium.
So, oh, I love it!
Yeah, and also I just kind of picked up a flute and taught myself the fingerings when I was in high school, but I've forgotten all of that now, and I learned about overblowing, which is how they get into the next octave and how they get high notes and so forth. So all of that was knowledge that I took with me when I was trying to imagine, you know, what's it like to play. But even more, being in those community bands, I had ideas of what they sounded like together. And that's what composing for ensembles is all about.
Well, where did it then take you, David? Upon what was your path upon leaving Vermont to becoming a composer?
Well, I went to New England Conservatory as a composition major, so I actually had to send music and so forth as my audition. And I was in a four-year program that was designed for composers, which meant 4 years of private study with another composer, a senior composer, shall we say, and getting figuring out how to get performances of my own music, since there were a lot of performers around, and they had concerts and so forth for the student music, and that's when I sort of got my chops. But also, I heard a lot of stuff that was unlike what I had heard in high school, so I had a lot of things to kind of put together in my head, and that's what composers do. In fact, my first year at New England Conservatory, there was an international contemporary music festival in Boston, and in fact, I was in one of the pieces in the chorus for that with the Boston Symphony, believe it or not.
Oh my.
And yeah, but you know, I got to hear a lot of different things that were being done, and they were all very stimulating. I didn't know how to combine them or how they were made, but you know, what you do is you go to the records. Hey, it was vinyl at the time, and listen to the pieces and take out the scores and figure out, you know, this is really cool. How can I do something like that?
Well, that's where I want to take it next. I know this is going to sound like it's some easy thing you just sit down and do, but how does one compose a piece of music like you do?
Oh, well, you have to try to imagine things, and you know, there's you imagine melodies, you imagine textures, you imagine sound, color, and so forth. And most of the stuff that comes to mind right away is turns out to be garbage. So you also have to develop a kind of filter. Oh, this would work. This one wouldn't. Oh, and this is what revising is about.
Yeah.
Just going with your first idea is not always the right thing to do, because sometimes you can figure out a better way. So there you go.
Are there always compositions playing in the head of David Rakowski?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not my own compositions, but mostly it's existing music. And, you know, this year I taught the first year music theory, and the final project was to write a minuet in the style of Haydn for a string quartet. And two of them were so good, I've still got those pieces going through my head as well as anything else I might hear on the radio, or even my own pieces sometimes. Often, though, you know, I do most of my pre-composing in the half hour or hour before I wake up, before I get out of bed in the morning.
Right.
Of course, I'm awake already. And so I'm thinking of what I've already done and just trying to put a pile of strategies on the table, figurative table, of what I might do next, what I might do with these things.
Oh, fantastic.
So that's what waking up early is good for.
David, has it changed much from when you started with the technology we now have compared to 30 or 40 years ago?
Certainly. The way you get your work out there certainly has changed, because it used to be you had to spend time at a copy machine and a binding machine and making cassettes and so forth, and putting into a mailing bag and taking to the post office and paying postage to if someone wanted to hear your work, that's what you had to do. And then, you know, in the last 15-20 years, it's been things where MP3s and SoundCloud and YouTube and so forth, you can just give YouTube links or even links on Spotify as ways of promoting yourself, and you don't have to go to the post office anymore. I remember the amount of postage that I would deduct on my taxes every year has come down by about 98%.
So, oh, that's great.
So it's like, oh, I heard that you had a quintet perform the other day. Is there any way I can hear it? And I say, yes, it's on SoundCloud. Just go to this link. Mm-hmm. And that's much easier than standing by the copier and a binding machine and making a cassette. When the CDs came out, that was great. But now the CD drives have disappeared in the last like 6-7 years. If I give a CD to a student, they say, what's this? where do I put this? In 1996, when I started at Brandeis, CD burners were brand new.
Oh, yeah.
And I recorded the final project readings and sent them all CDs. And the parents were like, how did you get that? Brandeis is a really advanced place.
Now, you've created a series of 100 piano etudes, something I understand you love. What are these pieces? How do they help musicians with, I think, like their dexterity and technique?
Well, yeah, the idea of etude actually comes from when Beethoven was still alive, because suddenly there was this whole body of work, Beethoven's, that had so many different things in it, all of which were of supreme difficulty. And they were hard to practice because they kept changing mood and changing texture. So some composers decided to make it a commercial that we would take one of these Beethoven techniques and do nothing but that in a piece. And that's what the etude was about. It was taking one thing and doing it obsessively. And I like the idea of taking something that may not seem promising at first and using my imagination to make it go in all kinds of other different interesting directions. And that was sort of what attracted me to writing etudes. And also pianists started asking for etudes and so forth. And suddenly I had this big body of work, and pianists liked them because, quote, they fit underneath the fingers. And, you know, you think a lot of composers writing for piano don't really play piano, and they don't know if something's going to be hard, or they might just imagine something that actually can't be played. It can be played on the computer, sure, but it's hard to do live. So pianists started asking for them. They started getting, you know, around. And once I had made some movies of etudes being played and put them on YouTube, then they just totally exploded. You still there?
I am here. And
you've also done
100 preludes. But I want to make sure before we end this conversation, we also talk about your typeface designs. Because music.
Yeah, I
would find musical composition and typeface creation as not logical bedfellows. Is there some connection between the two?
The original connection was that, you know, to have a teaching job at a major university, you have to have a doctorate. And to get a doctorate, you have to write a dissertation. And when I was writing my dissertation, I didn't have a font with musical symbols that was usable at all, so I made my own. And since I had the program right there, I started seeing books of typefaces, which I would scan and make into fonts. And sometimes I would, you know, just make up my own design, especially things based on my own writing and so forth. And here's something strange, and this is very, very strange. I just met a writer who published a novel about Chinese culture and so forth in 1997. And, you know, I got the book, and the headings on all the chapters looked kind of familiar. And I realized that the typographer at the time took a font that I made of my own handwriting and used it for the chapter headings. And so here's someone I've just met who's got a book with my handwriting in it via a font.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's really weird, yeah.
I would say that's almost better than being nominated twice for the Pulitzer Prize for Music, but I don't think so. Tell me what kind of an honor that is to be recognized in that way with the Pulitzer nominations.
It's a very big honor to be recognized by your peers, especially by your peers who have been doing it a lot longer than you have. And if they thought they saw something in it that they really liked, and so, you know, it came toward, you know, towards the top of the pile. I wasn't intending on winning any awards with these things, but, you know, these things happen. So there you go.
Now, I know you've done 100 etudes, 100 preludes. Are you working on 100 of anything else right now, David?
No, not right now. Right now I'm writing a string quartet.
Oh, beautiful.
But, you know, having written 200 piano pieces, it's like, how can I do something I haven't already done?
Right.
It gets harder and harder because I just there's all these possibilities, and I've taken away 200 of them. How many are left?
Well, how do you do that? Where do you go to find new inspiration and new sounds that, you know, that can help in your composition?
Well, you go to concerts of recent music. You buy recordings of recent music, and sometimes, you know, just listening to hearing pop songs at a restaurant will give me ideas and so forth. Because, you know, there is a lot of jazz and pop that makes it into my pieces, but usually it's very secret because of, you know, copyright laws. So.
Yeah, I think in your etudes, I think you've been, there's been like a funk riff and even a cell phone tone. So.
Yes. Yes, funk riff, cell phone. Well, I mean, a generic funk, because the original challenge was write a piece on Tower Power licks. And I just said, well, Tower Power owns the copyright on those. So there are a lot of licks that appear in James Brown and Parliament Funkadelic and Tower of Power and so forth. I can use those things that everybody just seems to use as a lingua franca. So that's what that piece is about. And, wow. But I turn them differently. I mean, they get different chords and they develop in different ways. Yeah. So there.
Oh, I love it. David Rutkowski has received 2 nominations for the Pulitzer Prize for Music. He teaches composition at Brandeis University, and he's a proud son of St. Albans. David, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a great honor.
It's been our pleasure. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan, and you can feel free to suggest guests or topics by emailing us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint and subscribe to the podcast at wdevradio.com. And Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. It's Election Day. Be sure to vote, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we get a primary election recap from Middlebury College political science professor Matt Dickinson.